You're listening to The Radiator 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Jacqueline Woodson, author of 12 books for children and adolescents. Jacqueline Woodson is a winner of the Margaret A. Edwards Award for Lifetime Achievement in Writing for Young Adults, the recipient of 3 Newbery Honors for After Tubach and Dee Foster, Feathers and Show Way, and a 2-time finalist for the National Book Award for Locomotion and Hush. She's now a finalist again for the National Book Award for Brown Girl Dreaming, the memoir that we discuss in today's interview. Other awards include the Coretta Scott King Award and Los Angeles Times Book Prize for Miracles Boys. She lives with her family in Brooklyn, New York. Raised in South Carolina and New York, Woodson always felt halfway home in each place. In Brown Girl Dreaming, she shares in vivid poems what it was like to grow up as an African American in the 60s and 70s, living with the remnants of Jim Crow and her growing awareness of the civil rights movement. Touching and powerful, each poem is both accessible and emotionally charged, each line a glimpse into a child's soul as she searches for her place in the world. Woodson's eloquent poetry also reflects the joy of finding her voice through writing stories, despite the fact that she struggled with reading as a child. Her love of stories inspired her and stayed with her, creating the first sparks of the gifted writer she was to become. When I spoke with Jacqueline Woodson, I began by asking her which came first for Brown Girl Dreaming, the subject, writing a memoir, or the form, which is verse.
I think it was the subject, and as I knew what I was going to talk about, I started writing down pieces of memory, and as I wrote them down, I realized that this is how they were coming to me. So this was going to eventually be the shape of the book.
So you didn't plan on it being verse. That's just how it sort of started to come out.
Yep, exactly.
That's wonderful. That must have been kind of exciting.
It was. It was really exciting. I think what it made me realize is it's kind of how memory works for a lot of people. It's just these small moments in time with all this white space around them. But the moments are very concrete and how visual they are.
Right, yeah. I have some questions later about what you remembered as you went. But before we get to that, I wondered, would you mind reading one of the pieces?
Sure.
So I wondered if you could read Second Daughter's Second Day on Earth, which is just on page 3.
Mm-hmm. Sure. My birth certificate says, female, Negro, mother, Marianne Irby, 22, Negro. Father, Jack Austin Woodson, 25, Negro. In Birmingham, Alabama, Martin Luther King Jr. is planning a march on Washington where John F. Kennedy is president. In Harlem, Malcolm X is standing on a soapbox talking about a revolution. Outside the window of University Hospital, snow is slowly falling. So much of it already covers this vast Ohio ground. In Montgomery, only 7 years have passed since Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on a city bus. I am born brown-skinned and black-haired and wide-eyed. I am born Negro here and colored there, and somewhere else the Freedom Singers have linked arms, their protest rising in song. Deep in my heart, I do believe that we shall overcome someday. And somewhere else, James Baldwin is writing about injustice, each novel, each essay, changing the world. I do not know yet who I'll be, what I'll say, how I'll say it. Not even 3 years have passed since a brown girl named Ruby Bridges walked into an all-white school. Armed guards surrounded her while hundreds of white people sat and called her name. She was 6 years old. I do not know if I'll be strong like Ruby. I do not know what the world will look like when I am finally able to walk, speak, write. Another Buckeye, the nurse says to my mother. Already I am being named for this place, Ohio, the Buckeye State. My fingers curl into fist automatically. This is the way, my mother said, of every baby's hand. I do not know if these hands will become Malcolm, raised and fisted, or Martin's open and asking, or James's curled around a pen. I do not know if these hands will be Rosa's or Ruby's, gently gloved and fiercely folded, calmly in a lap, on a desk, around a book, ready to change the world.
Thank you for reading that. I loved that. I love this whole book, but I loved that piece, and it made me wonder, particularly because so much of this book probably rested on your having memories of your childhood and recovering memories or remembering things. I wondered, do you have a first memory of realizing the existence of race?
That's a really good question. I think I didn't. I know it was down south. I knew there was an energy to the way black people and white people interacted, but I didn't know what that energy was about. And I think it really started dawning on me when my younger brother was born, and he was born half white. And I saw the difference in our skin tones, but I also heard the way people talked about him and, you know, how he was going to be and what the impact of his coloring was going to be in South Carolina and all of that stuff. But it was kind of a slowly formed realization of white and black. And it wasn't, you know, I mean, my family talked about white people this or white people that and, right. and that kind of stuff. But it didn't make sense to me for a long time.
Yeah. Okay. Great. So I was also interested, Jacqueline, to read about the relationship between your mother and your father's mother, Grace. They were friends first, it sounds like, and they were close. And it sounded like their friendship came out of the fact that they were both from the same place.
Yeah, it turned out that they were both from Greenville, South Carolina. And I don't know. I don't think my mother knew Grace before she knew Jack, my father.
Oh, okay.
But once he met my father, and, you know, it's the African-American world is small.
Yes.
And so, you know, when she got to Ohio and she knew that when she met Grace and they had people in common and they had this common ground, which was Greenville, South Carolina, and this connection because of it, because, you know, they knew that there was that connection and that they could go back to the before place of the Woodsons. And
right.
So it was, and I didn't know this until much later on.
Well, the one thing that really struck me, there's a lot about race in the book. There's also a lot about North and South, and reading about their friendship. Do you mind if I read a couple lines?
Not at all.
This is from the poem where you write about their friendship. They are home to each other. Grace to my mother is as familiar as the Greenville air. Both know that southern way of talking without words. Remember when the heat of summer could melt the mouth. So southerners stayed quiet, looked out over the land, nodded at what seemed like nothing. But that silent nod said everything anyone needed to hear. And it goes on. But I was just thinking about the North and South distinction. And it's almost like two separate countries in the way that expats might befriend one another in a foreign place. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And just how important that is in this country, the difference between North and South still. Did that strike you?
It completely strikes me. It, you know, the book is so much about a search for home, and I think that is what all of those small moments are. You know, here's a connection to home for my mother in Grace. Here's a connection to home for Grace in my mother. And then my mother goes back home, and then she looks for another home, that because the back home is not the same home it once was. And that sense of all of us needing a place to belong, and people to belong to. So and for me growing up in both the North and the South, both of those places feel very much like home to me, but the North was a foreign land to my mom and
right.
and to my grandmother.
Yeah. That's really interesting. And a lot of this book does talk about sort of like where is home and how do I feel in place in each place. And the other thing that really interested me is in your after note You talk about Ohio still feeling like a part of you, even though you were a really tiny baby when you left there, and yet your strong sense of family connected you to that place too.
Yeah, and it does help that my parents got back together when I was 14.
Right.
So you know, that part isn't in the book, and no, there won't be a sequel to talk about that part. But, it, you know, I think I was always a Buckeye, even when I didn't even know the Buckeye State or what a Buckeye was, because I had left it so early on. But you get named to the place before you can name yourself.
Right.
And so I, you know, I had my father's wet walk. I had my grandfather's easy way. I had, you know, I was like my Aunt Alicia in this way. So there was always this way in which the family was naming me. And so I, adopted those names. Those names became a part of me. And so I had a sense of Ohio even without living there. And I knew I was part of a long line of Woodsons because that was always being told to me, you know, there's
right.
no room for failure because of where you came from and who you are. So,
right. And there is a sense always of taking pride in our lineage, even though we weren't around to appreciate it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
So this is another thing that you address in your afternote, and we talked a little bit about this already, but I wondered if we could talk some more about, you know, at what point in the story were you drawing from memory rather than stories and your sense of things and maybe even some research?
All of it. It was interesting. The process was interesting because the first couple of drafts were just all the memories that I just had at my disposal, and it's kind of how my mind works. You know, there's a lot that I've memorized. There are a lot of my books that I've memorized. There are a lot of bad songs from the 70s that I memorized, TV commercials, like all of that stuff. I just, you know, I sometimes just want to reboot and start over. But so there was a lot of that was my memory, whether it was stuff that grandparents had told me, that my mother had told me, that aunts and uncles had told me, or stuff that I remember experiencing. And it gets muddled, you know, what was the thing I really was a part of and what was the thing that became a part of me because of the stories told and retold. And then as I wrote and rewrote, sometimes my editor would say, well, you know, there's a gap here. Something must have happened here when you were in, say, Bushwick. And, you know, I said, oh, yeah, we played in a Jenny pump all the time. Like, let me put that memory in there. And so that's how more memory got access, just from people asking questions.
Yeah, wonderful. I actually was going to ask you to read the Johnny Pump later. I love that
okay.
one, but I guess I thought I'd just go a little bit chronologically through your life. So actually, another one that I really loved was and I think it'll help talk a little bit about writing for children. And that's Lullaby, which is on page 58. Would you mind reading that one?
Sure. Lullaby. At night, every living thing competes for a chance to be heard. The crickets and frogs call out. Sometimes there's the soft hoo-hoo of an owl lost amid the pines. Even the dogs won't rest until they've howled at the moon. But the crickets always win, long after the frogs stop croaking and the owl has found its way home. Long after the dogs have lain down, losing the battle against sleep, the crickets keep going as though they know their song is our lullaby.
Mm, thanks. I just, I love that. And it made me think about how these voices from the natural world are some of the first things that we associate as children, you know, that we associate with and that will help us remember our childhoods. And that including that in poetry, in verse that you're writing for a child reader seems so important.
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting. I left the country and came to New York, and then for a long time, once my grandmother moved to the city, the country wasn't so much a part of us. But the minute I returned to the country, and I heard a cricket, or even I remember hearing a cricket in Brooklyn, and it nearly bringing tears to my eyes, and I couldn't remember what it was about that sound that was so visceral for me. And I think the same with the sound of pine or the smell of pine leaves. We have a pine tree up the block from my house here in Brooklyn, and every time I walk by it, I slow down because I feel like it takes me back to that place of my childhood. And I feel like it happens and we don't even know that it's happening. That, as you talk about the natural world, becomes a part of who we are. And so these small things can just set off that, you know, that memory or that feeling that we had. And for me, it's a feeling of comfort when I'm amid pine trees. I'm home. Right. I love pine trees. And I love the sound of crickets. And it just becomes, we were somewhere and someone was complaining about how loud they were. And I said, you know, I hear them and I don't hear them. They're just so much a part of me in that way.
Yeah, yeah. That really comes across. And it actually makes me think about the other side of my question, which is, you know, children raised in the city, and I wonder how they relate to these kinds of sense memories that you're writing about, and yet maybe they aren't growing up with crickets and the hoo-hoo and the, you know, maybe they get the dogs, but, you know, I think about the fresh air kids that come up to Vermont in the summertime to kind of experience the natural world for the first time. So maybe that's a little bit different for them.
Yeah, I think it does become a part of who they are. You know, that summer in Vermont, I think it does stay with them. And I think they miss home, which is the city, and the stuff that is becoming a part of who they are, the sound of cars, the fact that there is always light somewhere, the safety of that light, the fact that there's someone very close to them. There's another house right next door, the safety of that company. I mean, I think they have different sense memory that is just as valid and much more urban, but calming and protective in its urbanness.
Yeah.
I know for my kids, we had a house in the country for many years, and when we brought my goddaughter there, she was like, you know, it's too dark here. Like, where are the lights? Like, where are the people? And you know, we had a long talk about how, you know, some people love this.
Yeah.
And then my daughter, who had been going there until she was six, didn't love it either. And then, you know, and we also have family in Montpelier, so we go to Montpelier, Vermont a lot. And it's interesting because my kids love Vermont. My son is always like, it's so relaxing here. It's so peaceful here. And he says when he gets older, he's moving to Montpelier with the family. And my daughter's like, I'm never leaving New York. So it's interesting that they're having these same experiences, but they are growing up with different ideas of what comfort is.
Yeah, yeah. You're just reminding me of something I haven't thought about in a while, but when we moved to where we are, we were pretty much out in the country, and since then suburbia has come in and is very, now we're not so much in the country, but when we got a blinking red light down the block, my husband was so happy, because he's from Philadelphia, and he's like, I feel like the world is here. It was so funny.
That's great. That's so funny.
Okay, so I loved the picture that you paint of your sister helping you learn to write. And then later, she helped you learn to write your name and maybe other things too. And then later you share the fact that she would read to you. You also write about your mother punishing you and your sister and brother if you didn't speak correctly. And then you write about your grandmother sharing stories out loud. And all of this strikes me as so vital to your growth into this writer that you've become, especially despite the fact that you had a learning disability that made it hard for you to read. So I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about these influences and talk about your focus on them as you worked on the book. I thought it was so beautifully interwoven, all of these influences.
You know, it's so funny because my sister and brother, my older brother, were really intellectually beyond a lot of people when they got to Brooklyn. And it was, but my sister especially, my sister, you know, they always wanted to skip her. She was doing work outside of the range of anyone at school. Like, she was constantly getting these awards. And my brother too, my brother, you know, but part of that was my mother, there was no room for failure. I mean, they would get in trouble if I did poorly in school. So, you know, because my mother would say, you know, you guys are doing fine. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but like, what's wrong with Jackie? And that was the family name.
Right.
So they had to pull me up with them. And And, you know, my sister loved reading. She just read all the time. And my mother, we didn't have a home library, so she took us to the library once a week, and we were allowed to take out books. We got in trouble if they were overdue. Like, any, you know, it was a very literary family in that way. And my grandmother would tell us stories. And it's funny, because I don't think of it as a learning difference, what I had. I think I was a really, 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 really slow reader.
Oh,
and
okay.
There were these tests, well, you probably remember the SRAs,
yep.
These scholastic reading assessments or something, and it was a box of stories, and you were reading them for comprehension, and I hated them. Because they were pale to dark, and if you were reading at the pale cards, you were reading, you know, kind of remedially. But if you were reading at the black, you were a really good reader. And my sister was always out of the box. And I was always... But I'm looking back on it, and I think it was so much about how I was learning, how I was absorbing language, and I was absorbing all of it. And I think of it sort of like as someone who's learning, who's growing up bilingual. They speak much later than other kids, but when they speak, they're fluent in two languages.
Right.
And I think I think that's what was happening for me. I think from a really young age, I was experiencing the world as a writer, even though I didn't know that. I was looking at words, reading them over and over again until they became a part of my memory, until, you know, I knew the stories back and forward, basically, backwards and forward. And also, John Gardner talks about the dream of fiction in his book on becoming a novelist.
Yeah.
How when you're reading, you're in the fictive dream and something can break that dream and then you're out of it. And I think I didn't want the dream broken. And so, and it was broken by new vocabulary words. It was broken by, you know, by people, by sentences I didn't understand. I never, ever in my life failed a spelling test. You know, one of the awards I always got was the spelling award. Mm-hmm. And I knew words because I had studied them. They were so much a part of my memory. And it's interesting because looking back on it, I know in this day and age I would have gotten labeled dyslexic. I would have gotten labeled as someone with a learning difference. I would have gotten pushed in this way that I think would have made me struggle as a writer. Mm-hmm. But I definitely read very, very slowly and got a lot of extra time and extra help and had to be and made people wait for me, and that was not okay.
Yeah, that's...
so.
Now, there's this part in the book where you're talking about your very special fifth grade teacher, Mrs.
Vivo.
Vivo. Do you think that's when it started to turn around for you? That was such an electric moment in the book where you seem so excited to learn from her, not just about books, but also about the world. But do you think that was a point at which it started to become easier?
It was definitely a turning point for so many reasons. Miss Viva was a feminist, and
right.
That was, you know, that was a connection. Like all of a sudden, I was learning that it wasn't just a black struggle, that other people were struggling in other ways, that women were struggling. And one thing I remember is Miss Viva would always look at me. She'd make eye contact, and she'd always smile. And I hadn't remembered that happening so much with teachers before. And I feel like that was, she saw something in me, and I think that's what, you know, my sister was always brilliant, my brother was always brilliant, and I think that's what brilliance is when, you know, your passion is recognized and legitimized, and I feel like that's what happened to me in fifth grade,
yeah.
That suddenly people started saying, okay, this is her brilliance, you know, they probably didn't call it that, but this is something that Jacqueline has that is a good thing. And so it wasn't that I was average anymore. Suddenly I was something kind of outstanding in this way. So it was definitely a turning point.
Yeah.
But I remember, you know, it's so interesting. The other thing I remember, she was great. She had gray eyes. But it is interesting that it is the teachers making that kind of eye contact. And I try to do it when I go to schools and stuff. I really try to look students in the eyes when we're having one-on-one, because I think they do see us being them.
Yeah. It's very important for kids to feel like they're being heard and being just sort of paid attention to in that way.
So true.
Yeah. Okay, so Jacqueline, may I read another short paragraph and then talk to you?
Oh, please, yeah.
Okay, so this is from the poem titled Hair Night, which is about a session of having your hair brushed and straightened by your grandmother while your sister reads to you. And I'm just going to read a few lines. So I sit on my hands to keep my mind off my hurting head and my whole body still, but the rest of me is already leaving. The rest of me is already gone. And that's about how you've lost yourself in the stories. And I just loved this description of your childhood self, who was sort of anxious and fidgety in this moment, this uncomfortable moment, but also so entranced by story. And I wondered if your readers, who I think are largely, you know, young readers, do you think they recognize themselves in moments like this?
I think so many people recognize the hair moment, and it's so funny because I always thought it was my kind of hair, which is kinky and thick and, you know, and a lot of hair. And my daughter is so funny because whenever we take her to get her hair done, the person who does it says, she has no scalp. Like, it's just all hair, and it comes down past her back, and it's just so much hair. And I always thought it was, and she has corkscrew hair. And yeah. Then her sister who lives in Montpelier has bone straight hair. And I never thought that bone straight hair could get ratty, you know, could get tangled. And so when we're combing straight hair and the kids are, you know, upset about it, I'm like, but this is the easiest hair in the world, and it's not. So I think every kid knows what it means to have a head that's hurting and wanting to get out of that moment. And I didn't know that until I was an adult, that everyone has a hurting head at some moment.
Everybody, except boys.
Oh, yeah. Man, I know, you just cut it off, except my son has long hair now, so he hates getting his hair combed.
Okay, so your family moved to New York when you were still quite small. Your two brothers, you had a little infant brother at that point, and your sister and yourself and your mom. And some of the book concerns, much of the book concerns being in New York and this move. And I'm wondering if you could read the poem you mentioned earlier, The Johnny Pump, which is on 147.
Okay. Some days we miss the way the red dirt lifted up and landed against our bare feet. Here, the sidewalks burn hot all summer long. Here, we wear shoes. Broken bottles don't always get swept up right away. But our block has three Johnny pumps and a guy with a wrench to turn them on. On the days when the heat stops your breath, he comes up the block pulling it out of his pocket. Then the Johnny pump is blasting cool water everywhere, and us and other kids running through it, refreshed and laughing. Even the grown-ups come out sometimes. Once, I saw my never-ever barefoot outside in the city mother pick off her sandals, stand at the curb, and let the cool water run over her feet. She was looking up at the tiny piece of sky, and she was smiling.
Mm. I've never heard the expression the Johnny pump. Is that like am I like so completely out of the loop?
I wonder if your husband has heard of it, being from Philly.
Yeah, I have to ask him.
It was funny because I was talking to some kids a couple of weeks ago, and I asked them, and they didn't know what it was, and I think they were here in the city. But it's a fire hydrant, and we always called it the Johnny pump. So I think it's a certain. It's regional, and it's also a certain period in time where it was called that. And now they're all locked in the city, so you can't turn them on to send water gushing. They have sprinkler systems on them.
I wondered if the guy with the wrench was anybody official, or if he's just a guy with a wrench.
Oh, no, it's a guy with a wrench. You always hope that someone on your block had a wrench. And there was always some teenage guy who had a wrench who came up the block. And so on our block, I think there were four of them, and he would just come up the block and turn every single one on. And it was so funny. And you see, I mean, like, you look at Crooklyn, the Spike Lee movie, you can see the Johnny pump and the guy turning it on and the kids with the cans. You you take out the top and the bottom of a can and you use it to kind of force the water in different directions. It was awesome.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you see a lot of photographs of kids playing in the city in the water from the hydrants mm-hmm. or the Johnny pumps. So I could have picked almost any piece from this book, but this one was the one I picked, and I felt like this would be a good time to talk about the use of detail to convey story and also a sense of place and a sense of emotion. You always infuse everything with such beautiful detail, and I wonder if we can talk about that.
Yeah, definitely. I was talking to some kids, and I told them to stay away from too many adjectives. Because I think you don't need a whole lot of adjectives to get to detail. You just need concrete detail.
Yeah.
And a sort of paintbrush, you know, just these brush strokes of moments can get it on the page. I mean, like you were saying, even though you've never heard the phrase Jenny Pump, you know from how I describe it on the page that kind of what it is.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I knew it was a hydrant. I just had not heard the expression before. Yeah, absolutely. So the other thing I was going to ask you about is, you know, early in the poem it says, the way the red dirt lifted up and landed against our bare feet. And then later mm-hmm. you have your never ever barefoot outside in the city mother. And mm-hmm. I just wondered, you know, how purposeful might be your decision to return to that image from earlier in the poem? Or was that just the way the memory flowed as you wrote?
You know, I don't remember. I feel like red dirt is such a part of my memory because our shoes were always covered in it. Mm. And it was, I love the way it felt on my bare feet, and we were always barefooted. And so I did want to show that suddenly we were shooed, you know, yeah. that was part of the transition, that here's my mom. I think in the poem where my mother looks back on Greenville, she's outside and she's standing barefoot with her coffee cup. I'm talking about the wet, the dew in the grass, and yeah. suddenly here we are, and it's a new world, and there's glass on the ground. So I don't know. I think the dirt comes up a lot just because it infused every single memory.
Okay. Yeah, it's sort of like people who live at the beach have to deal with the sand.
Uh-huh. And yeah. and there's that part in the book where I'm imagining the ocean and it's, yeah. you know, water washing over red dirt, because I can't even imagine sand because I've never seen it. So I think, okay, here's water and here's the surface of the ocean. Here's the surface of the beach. It must be red dirt.
Right. I'm going to change the focus of our conversation a little bit now, because I want to talk about the actual look of the book. It is absolutely beautiful. I love your cover. And I'm wondering if you had any input, and you must have been thrilled when you saw it.
It's so funny. I wish I could show the world the different covers we went through before we got through this. When I saw this, I loved it.
Yeah.
And there were some changes that we made. The girl was shorter, and I had always had really skinny, long legs, like super skinny, super long. And so we ended up stretching out her legs, and my name was at the top, which is the case of a lot of my books, and because people recognize Jacqueline Woodson. Mm-hmm. And I got them to move my name to the bottom, and we went back and forth about the butterfly swirling out of the book. But there was so much on the cover, but there was so much about it. When I saw it, I was like, you did it. You yeah. nailed it. I still can look at this book. Sometimes after a while, I can't look at my covers anymore. But this one, I felt like I still look at it and think that's such a beautiful. I love the way the light comes through. And in my other books, I talk a lot about light. So
yeah.
I just think so much of what I've written up until now and who I was as a child is all on this cover.
Yeah, and it says on the back the design is by Teresa Evangelista, so I guess we should give her mm-hmm. a little applause here because it's great.
Yeah. Oh, and then Ryan, I forget Ryan's last name, but he's the one who designed the inside of the book with the photos
okay.
and everything.
Yeah, and that's I was going to ask you about that next. Um, I I like the stylistically, and I have an advanced reader's copy, so I don't know that I have everything here, but I like stylistically, I like the font, I like the fact that all the little verse titles are in lowercase, and just, I don't know, just, was that your idea? Was that his idea?
That was Ryan Tommen, I think that's, yeah. And he's the one, so he's the one who designed the fonts and all of that, and he also in the final book in the back there are photographs of everybody who I talk about in the book.
Oh,
and
that
so
one.
Yeah, we'll send you that one definitely.
No, you don't have to. And
then he put their kind of vintage the way he put them into the book. It's really beautiful.
Oh, great! That's wonderful. I'll have to check it out. Okay, so. I'm wondering what, Jacqueline, what are you reading these days, and is there anything in particular that you might recommend to my listeners?
A book that I'm reading right now, I don't know if it's out yet. They sent it to me to get a blurb, and it's called Listen Slowly, and it's stunning. It's funny. It's about a girl who's Vietnamese, and she's from California, but she goes back to, Vietnam with her grandmother, but she's very much a Southern California girl. And it's by Tan Ha Lai, the same person who wrote Inside Out and Back Again. It's stunning. I'm also reading to my son lots of Tony Baloney books because that's what he likes. He's Pam Muniz, Ryan. And I'm also reading The Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears, which is also an amazing book. So yeah. I'm usually reading more than one book at a time.
Yeah. Do you read a lot of children's fiction? Do you read a lot of adult fiction? Do you read everything?
I read adult fiction when I'm writing, and I read children's fiction and middle grade and young adult when I'm between books, just because I don't want my own writing influenced by other children and young adult writers.
That's smart. I would think reading sort of middle grade and children's books would also be a really good happy place to be when you have to market a book. So.
Oh man, yes, definitely. That's a really good point.
Okay, and what are you working on these days? Are you between projects or are you working on something?
I'm between projects. I have an adult book that's due in March, and I'm going to start working on it again in January, I think. I'm just taking a little time off. I might start back in December. It's almost done. But so I'm just trying to... I feel like Brown Girl Dreaming took me so long to write, and it was so emotionally and kind of physically exhausting. So I have a friend who's an actor, and she always talks about the fallow period between films where she can let herself get out of shape and everything. And so now, during my writing is my fallow period because I'm just sitting and writing and not exercising. So now I'm trying to get back in shape before I start another book.
That's
so after
great.
This interview, I'm going to go for a 3-mile run.
Oh, fun. Okay, great.
Yeah.
I just have a couple more questions, and then you can go for your run.
Sure.
Do you have any advice about what an aspiring writer might want to keep in mind as she or he works on a picture book versus a book for middle grade children versus a YA book? A lot of my listeners are writers, so that's a question I thought I could ask you.
I think picture books are the hardest to write. So I think you have a really short amount of space to hold a really short attention span, and you can lose them really quickly. I think people tend to think they are easier because they have less words, but I didn't come to picture books until I had written about 10 other books. I think, it was Madeline L'Engle who said when you write remembering the child you were, because the essence of childhood doesn't change. And I think that people, instead of thinking about children or grandchildren or nieces and nephews, they should go back to themselves as children and start writing from there and try to get as much of that on the page as they can. And be fearless. I think so much of what stops us is fear. So
yeah.
Whenever I write, I say nobody is going to see this, and then I write the first you know, chapters or drafts. And then when I show it to people I trust, I say, tell me only what you love about it. So it really helps me get the story on the page without having to think about criticism. So.
Okay, wonderful. That's great advice. Okay, I thought maybe we would finish up with your reading the piece called A Writer, which was, I have to be honest, it made me cry a little bit. and I thought that it would probably make just about any child who wants to write feel like that is possible, and I just loved it. So it's on 311. I wondered if you could read that one.
Sure. You're a writer, Miss Beville says, her gray eyes bright behind thin wire frames. Her smile bigger than anything, so I smile back, happy to hear these words from a teacher's mouth. She is a feminist, she tells us, and 35th grade hands bend into death where our dictionaries wait to open yet another world to us. Miss Beville pauses, watches our fingers fly. Webster's has our answers. Equal rights, a boy named Andrew yells out, for women. My hands freeze on the thin white pages. Like blacks, Miss Beville too is a part of a revolution. But right now that revolution is so far away from me. This moment, this here, this right now is my teacher saying, you're a writer. As she holds the poem I am just beginning, the first four lines stolen from my sister. Black brothers, black sisters, all of them were great. No fear, no fright, but a willingness to fight. You can have them, Del said when she saw. I don't want to be a poet. And then my own pencil moving late into the evening. In big fine houses live the whites. In little old shacks live the blacks. But the blacks were smart. In fear, they took no part. One of them was Martin with a heart of gold. You're a writer, Miss Beville says, holding my poem out to me. And standing in front of the class, taking my poem from her, my voice shakes as I recite the first line. Black brothers, black sisters, all of them were great. But my voice grows stronger with each word because more than anything else in the world, I want to believe her.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for reading that poem and for speaking with me today. I just want to say this was a conversation with Jacqueline Woodson, whose new book is Brown Girl Dreaming, published by Nancy Paulson Books, which is part of Penguin. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Jacqueline Woodson. You can learn more about her work at her website, jacquelinewoodson.com, and her name is JACQUELINE Woodson. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crows Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule. Custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crows Trading Post on Facebook. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Jacqueline Woodson. Choose an age between 5 and 15 and write down everything you remember from that year of your life. Who were your friends? Where did you live? What clothes did you wear? What music was playing? What did you love? What did you hate? Write without lifting your pen until you can't remember anything else and then start to make stuff up. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at my podcast site, which is writethebook.podbean.com, and those are free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast and my new blog, The Silent G, by going to my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. I went through a period of time where I was getting a lot of suggestions about guests, and that was really fun. It's always fun to invite somebody on the show because it's been requested, so feel free. Get in touch. Let me know if you have a writer that you'd really like to hear interviewed. The email again is writethebook@gmail.com. Do remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about contributing to the Radiator or volunteering or in some way making yourself a part of this wonderful place is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.